Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the new year, and welcome to the January 2025 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research, and here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. So the PCRF, remember, we have a lot of sponsors, and one of our fabulous sponsors is Limmer Education. So we want to thank Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring to you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey. I'm here with Michael Caduce and Dr. Kim McKenna. And Dave Page was here just a minute ago, but poof, I think maybe he lost power or lost connection. So hopefully we'll be able to connect him back from the frozen tundra and join us, because we have a really great article to talk about. This is an article published this year. It's open access, so you can grab it in the journal Annals of Medicine. And it is called Assessing the Impact of Clerkships on the Growth of Clinical Knowledge. So thank you all for joining us today. And remember that you can use your chat feature on your screen to type in questions. You can talk amongst yourselves. You have ideas. We'll bring those into the conversation as we go. Kim usually and Michael keeping an eye on those comments, and we'll bring those into our conversation. But remember too, first, if you happen to be like Dave and lose connection, or if you happen to miss any of the podcasts, or you want to catch some of our past ones, remember you can go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@PCRF@UCLA. You can subscribe, and you can also catch the clinical podcasts as well. All right, so let's take a look at this article. Ah, here comes David. I'm so glad we're getting you back. Oh, and thank you. Michael Caduce just put into the chat the link to this article, so you can directly pull it up. I loved this article for so many reasons, but I do have to tell you, I had to read it a couple of times. I think it's really well written in the intro. It's got a lot of great learning theory in it. The discussion is fantastic. The stats were a little above me, just a little. That's a, you know, understatement. But I understand what they were getting at. So maybe if anybody has some input on the type of stats that they use, the programs that they used, it's pretty cool. But I loved it because it really resonated with some of the things that have been done. I'm so glad Dave's back, because early on when we were part of those research summits and FISDAP research summits, and we looked at, you know, the impact of clinical rotations on acquisition of knowledge and critical thinking scores on tests, all the way through the present day, and Kim McKenna has been working on this for many years, the impact of experiential learning and reflection on student learning, but also the development overall of the current clinical judgment model from the National Registry, that I know Michael's been working on some of that, Kim's been working on it. So we have a great input in this. A lot of things that mirror what we've been doing in EMS, even though this is really with medical students and clinical clerkships. So it's grounded in experiential learning theory, and it addresses issues that we've looked at over the years at, like I said, at research summits in the National Registry Clinical Judgment Model. And essentially, the background on this is we know that you have challenges assessing the effect of clinical clerkships or clinical experiences on student learning outcomes. Not only that, but if you're part of a paramedic program, you know we have challenges even getting the clinical sites. And so at some point we start to say, okay, you know, how much value are we getting? Are the students getting out of this? Are they, you know, learning, and how do we evaluate that? And a lot of things go with that question, like what tests do you use to tell whether or not a student is learning? You know, how are we using it? What's the testing process? And then how often are we using it? What points in time are critical to kind of document the progression of student learning? So this study in particular looks at third-year medical student clerkships. So there's a standardized process, you know, in the third year of medical school, there are clerkships, and there are rotations that they go through. In this case, we'll go through the methodology in a minute, but they use the experiential learning model. And those of you maybe who've studied a little bit about experiential learning will recognize some of the names here, you know, Kolb, Piaget, and John Dewey and others. And it culminates in sort of a cycle of observing and applying to real world patient encounters, observing clinical experts, and then reflecting. This is where Kim's expertise came in, reflecting to refine your understanding and finally developing your clinical decision making based upon this experience. And in medicine, there's a standardized tool. Called the Comprehensive Clinical Science Exam, which I've looked it up, and it's a multiple choice test. You know, they have some examples that you can look up if you look up the CCSE, and it's vignettes, you know, scenario based, sometimes with five, you know, possible answers, sometimes with eight possible answers, sometimes diagnostic questions, sometimes treatment questions. But it's a way of testing kind of that clinical decision making, clinical knowledge. And in medicine, this standardized tool is used for periodic evaluation of knowledge at the end of the clerkship. But there's a lot of variability among schools. You know, at what time do they do this? What grading rubric do they use in terms of evaluating learning during a clerkship? So what this group proposed to do was to use this CCSE as a formative assessment tool. So what they aim to do overall was they want to quantify the impact of those clinicals on the growth of the medical student's disciplinary knowledge. So they want to look at what we always call the progression of learning and their development of competency. And they propose that this standardized tool that's been validated, the CCSE, can be used as a formative assessment tool to quantify this growth over time. So they used it to examine performance before, during, and after their clerkship experiences in five different disciplines. And they looked at at six time points and the differential effects of the various rotations on their acquisition of clinical knowledge within that discipline. So really interesting kind of proposal here. So Kim, I thought of you immediately when I saw the background in the learning theory in experiential learning theory.
Well, yeah, I it's near and dear to my heart. I really think I should have had my doctorate in educational psychology, but I don't. So, I put it in the chat. One of my favorite sayings from Dewey is an experience without reflection is an experience, and an experience with reflection is learning. And I think you might even have that tagged onto your
I
email.
do on my signature line.
I
It's
know.
not
I
experience
know.
unless you're reflecting on that experience, right? It's
Right.
not learning. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I loved about this was that it was longitudinal, right? They were looking at that progress over time. And if you think about in EMS, like early on, David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Louise Brugiglio and others looked at the correlation between certain clinical experiences and their ability to answer critical thinking questions. And so that really did like inform us as educators about where we should have our learners spending their time. Go, Dave.
This was amazing, and I still have it in all of my slide decks when I talk about sort of how to succeed in patient care, but and particularly also succeed on the National Registry, because the National Registry does really evaluate your ability to use clinical judgment, critical thinking, make decisions. And so the studies had a one-to-one correlation. The more patient contact, the better you did. But also, really incredible the work that Ron Lawler did, trying to really dig down to what types of experiences would develop this critical thinking. And the types of complaints with wide differentials, that is, abdominal pain, shortness of breath, altered mental status. difficulty breathing. These could be many different things, and so they develop the ability of the student to try and differentiate. You think about the words that I'm using in terms of Bloom, and my master's is in experiential education, and I just love Dewey. I love all of the pieces. I think one of the quotes is that Plato said way back when was, "Experience develops our best flute players and our worst." So experience alone doesn't really mean that you're kind of acquiring new knowledge and improving your abilities. And this cycle of see it, come back, study it, review it, go back and do it is exactly what case-based learning, problem-based learning medical schools have been doing forever. And I think this paper really applies it to how does that experiential learning then translate into improvement? And I can't wait to when we start talking about the results, because it really, you can see in certain areas where we don't get a lot of experience and we can't simulate it very well, the exposure to patient care really matters. So we have an expert actually who's in the David Geffen Medical School with us. So Dr. Davis can comment a little bit about clerkships and how this particular type of evaluation works, because she's in charge of assessments at the David Geffen School of Medicine. So welcome, Dr. Davis.
Hi, sure. So this comprehensive exam is not required at all schools. It's a choice to be used. So some schools choose to use it and others do not. It is a comprehensive or longitudinal exam. Most schools, though, use what are called the shelf exams or content exams. So there's an exam for OBGYN clerkship. There's an exam for the neurology clerkship. There's an exam for the emergency medicine clerkship. So for all the core clerkships, that happen in either the second or the third year. And at Michigan State, this was the third year that they did the core clerkships. Usually it's just one that would cover the 4 weeks. And so that may have been happening as well, that they were taking the exam for just the content of OB and just the content of neuro and just the content of peds, and then also doing repeated measures of this comprehensive exam that's sort of like how well are they putting it all together? Usually, what would happen is they're using this exam, schools are using this exam at the end of the clerkship year in order to gauge readiness for what's called the USMLE Step 2 exam, as a predictive measure. And the psychometrics are so good on this comprehensive practice exam that literally it will tell you if you take the USMLE Step 2 within a week, you have this probability of success on the exam, of passing the exam, or your predictive score on the exam will be this. Now, a couple of years ago, the Step 1 exam, which if you notice in the paper, it says they've already taken. So these learners have already taken and passed a big comprehensive 6-hour exam, their first medical licensing exam. They've already taken it in order to get to these clerkships. So if you're thinking about could any of these effects be around just getting used to the exam? Probably not. They've done thousands of practice questions in order to prepare for the exam that they have already taken and passed to just get promoted to the year where they were even allowed to go take care of patients. So they've already done that. And so they're familiar with the types of questions with exams that are long and comprehensive like this. And then just a couple of other things to note is when they're giving this exam, it's a practice exam. So it is allowed to be done in a non-proctored environment. That's up to the school. So they could have said, hey, here's your voucher. You just need to take it at these time intervals. And you saw that it was phase one, two, and three, and they needed to take it repeatedly. And then I'll just remind folks of a couple of other things. Like we do know that there's testing effects, right? We get better at taking tests the more often we do it. And so that's one of the things that we can be seeing here in the effect is that the more often we take an exam, it primes retrieval, and so we get better. And then also the other thing that's happening is as we progress through the year, we know even on those shelf exams that are just content specific, so just medicine, just OB, just neurology, learners will get better on those exams throughout the year because they get the accumulation of knowledge. Now I've had family practice, I can apply that to my pediatrics knowledge. Now I've had family practice and pediatrics, I can apply that to my OB knowledge. And so just as your learners do, as they progress through clinical towards field internship, learners get better as they get more mature in their learning. And so we see that anyway as they progress through the third year. So.
Can you comment on who develops and who actually distributes the CCSE?
Sure, it's the National Board of Medical Examiners, so it would be their version of the National Registry. The exams, just like registry, has item writers who include all of us, who are subject matter experts, who are educators, who are clinicians, who are administrators, medical directors. Same idea. There are expert physicians from all the different disciplines who are invited to literally come to Philadelphia at the National Board of Medical Examiners and contribute to the item writing process. And then these items are typically retired medical licensing exam items that aren't retired because they're no longer relevant. They often come onto these practice exams just because they've been exposed too often, like they've been on the test long enough that they now come on to the practice exam, but they still have the psychometric properties that allow them to predict success on the actual exam.
Yeah, that's interesting. So they're actually distributed by the medical licensing board.
Yeah, and
So,
it's like $60 to take these exams. So the school is making a significant investment in learners to allow them to take a certain number of practice exams. Now, this was obviously a research project. So they, were purposely trying to see what the testing effect would be if they had multiple exposures and if any particular clerkship mattered, if something really accelerated their learning, et cetera. But just in general, when we, for example, we invest $90,000 a year in practice for the actual medical licensing exam. The step one exam is pass fail, but the step two exam, the clinical practice exam, still comes with an actual score that is important for residency selection. So they're using that as a way of determining candidacy for residency placement.
Fascinating. So cool that you were able to jump on because
Yes, thank
this is a
you.
world that what you said about the acquisition of knowledge, and as you acquire an understanding of obstetrics, maybe you do better in psychology, is really, it's sort of interesting because I find it fascinating that we in all of medicine have been super specific about the discipline, right? You learn this disease and then you go to the next disease and then you go to the next, system or set of diseases. And one of the things that is magical about the internship in EMS is you can't pick your calls. We can to send them to the hospital and like go, you're only going to go to the cardiac care unit. But even those patients are diabetics or they, have other medical issues that you might not have yet touched on. And so I think it's fascinating to think about it, a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to bite into. When 911 gets called, the person who looks drunk is having a seizure, and the person who was supposed to be having abdominal pain because of one obstetric issue is actually completely having a different one. So I find it amazing that that this particular study is showing the accumulation of that ability, and that the sort of I treated this patient and it helped me with this discipline, but it helps me on other types of complaints is super, super cool.
I would invite Kim to comment on this because she did a session on this at NEMCA either last year or the year before about the importance of interleaving. So as educators, it's so important that we keep drawing back from previous units. And sometimes we're not awesome at that. We're like, we have so much content to deliver in trauma that we forget to bring back some of what we did it related to other topic areas. And we have to sort of remind learners about, remember when we were talking about this? This is evident here. This is how you know that, or this is, see how that's bringing up. So let me let Kim talk about that, because this interleaving is exactly what's happening in what you're seeing here in this paper, and why some of what was happening in clerkships, but it's also what you're describing, Dave, in the box of chocolates and the way that really good clinicians can pivot when we get those calls that we weren't anticipating.
Well, I was just going to say first that 40 to 50% of this exam relates to diagnosis, right? And so it, to speak to interleaving, like whether I'm diagnosing an OB patient or a behavioral patient or whatever, I learn how each time I practice or encounter a patient, I learn how to hone those skills. And then the other piece of that, and so whether you're doing it in OB or whether you're doing it in medicine, whatever, you're going to get better at that to be able to better take care of the other patients that you encounter. That's why the field experience is so important when you start to team lead, because that makes you do those things, right? Making people sort of think on the fly when you're interleaving content and you're introducing various concepts, like for example in lab where you're in the middle of cardiology, but maybe you're introducing something that it is endocrine as well, and so it makes them kind of interleave those things together so that they can solve it. But the other piece that I wanted to add, and they mentioned this I think in the discussion, is that there are some things, and David brought this up, there are some things that you can't measure the value of them. They call it the multidimensional latent construct is something that is you're learning from every experience, but the things you're learning are super hard to measure, and they're really so interrelated that you cannot measure them by asking one question alone. So that was all I was going to add.
Yeah, that's great. So let me just go into who we're talking about here. This is great background and foundation now to move into what they actually did. So they had this is as Heather said, it was at the College of Human Medicine at Michigan State University. This is 155 third-year medical students. These were required tests at this location. So in this case, they were all what we would call quote participants. They were not recruited. This was part of their testing that occurred during these clerkships, and it went through fall of 2018, spring of 2019, summer of 2019. And these were discipline exams. And what you're looking at, if you can see the screen right now, is figure one, which is an example of what this reminds me very much of what we got from National Registry, where you see the near passing, below passing, above passing kind of thing, instead of an actual numeric score. And so that kind of poses an issue here. So if you want to look at progression of learning, what they did was, and this is where the methodology and statistics was, I had to read this several, I still have to read this again because I'm not completely clear on it, so maybe somebody else can help. But essentially, you get these performance, this bar chart, and you can see in different areas. Down at the bottom are the discipline areas that they look at in this study. So, but this is an actual bar interval graph from a number of different areas on this CCM or CCSE. And what they're going to do is take the five discipline areas and look at progression of learning at six different time points. But because they didn't have numeric scores, they digitized these bar charts using a program called Plot Digitizer, which I did look up, and it's pretty cool. There's YouTube videos on it. I don't know if anybody's used Plot Digitizer, but it seemed like something that Michael Caduce would know about. I don't know if you do, Michael, but it seemed like one of those cool. How do you take a data visualization and make it into an actual quantifiable score? But it and they use this they created this range of numbers 0 to 100 so that they could get actually a starting point and then comparison of the different scores at the 6 different time intervals. And they used stepwise regression. They evaluated different scores between the phases. So at 6 time points, 155 students are talking about 930 observations in total. And what they wanted to do was compare the different phases. So here you see the descriptive statistics in table one. You see the different specialties: internal medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, psychiatry, and surgery. The 6 different time intervals. Now, keep in mind too, they had to do this adjustment because not every student is doing the clerkship. They're not going at the same time to the same rotation. So scheduling is always just like, just like us, kind of all over the place for different students, but they do have a time interval. So if you are assigned to internal medicine, you have 4 weeks, 4 weeks in OBGYN, 4 weeks at pediatrics, 4 weeks psychiatry. It just may be in different orders. And then surgery is the only one that had, that's an 8-week clerkship. So this is again third year medical students going through these clerkships. So you're going to see that little difference in time interval in their data visualization. So overall, in the descriptive statistics, you're seeing, scores, basically the mean score, minimum maximums, and scores increasing across the board over time, which wasn't, a big surprise. But then when they do their regression, and which is a different, it's not, your standard regression. It's in stepwise, and they're trying to look between the phases, between the different phases. What they saw were comparing the you have the phase one, which is before they're actually in, then you have during, and then phase three is after the rotation. And you'll see in the visualization that I'll show in a second that you can see this over many months. So I think it's 10 months. And then the slice of it, of the clerkship is shown in between these dotted lines. But overall, what you're seeing is when they compared the phase two to phase one. So after, right after the start of the disciplinary rotation, they compare what they call the regression intercepts, before a clerkship and during, and compared to during it. They revealed that the student's average score increased the most in OBGYN, and you can see that in the very first area over here on the left, that OBGYN and psychiatry were the ones that showed the greatest increase, but also in pediatrics, and those three showed statistically significant increases in the acquisition of knowledge. And then the other two, they saw again increases except for surgery. You got a little drop in surgery in terms of knowledge. And then phase three to phase two is the next step in the middle there. And that's comparing the regression intercepts during the clerkship and after it. So that's during to after. And they found that the average scores improved the most in psychiatry. And you can see that 7.649 with statistical significance shown in the p value there. And followed by OBGYN and then surgery and all of those. And actually, OBGYN, I don't know if they were considering that. I think pediatrics only observed as statistically significant with psychiatry and surgery in that group, but you did see again increases. And then phase three to phase one looks at sort of the overall, and that disciplinary knowledge increased significantly pre to post clerkship in all of them. But again, with the statistical significance, was found in all but surgery. So, and you can see the biggest leaps in psychiatry, followed by OBGYN, then pediatrics, and then internal medicine. And then they had a great discussion about, the surgery. What are the possible reasons for this? But let's look at that. We'll look at the data visualization first. I like the way they use the term trajectory. They're looking at the score trajectory. What path are they on? In terms of their performance and their acquisition of competency, so I think that was a really good way of putting it. And these at first my at first couple of looks over this, I was completely like, what am I looking at here? Except that if you look carefully, I'm not sure what all the, how all the gray.
This looked like some like a
My,
2-year-old's drawing
yeah,
at
I was
the
just gonna say
beginning. I
my
was just like,
granddaughter did this.
what?
My
And
granddaughter presented these five charts
yeah,
to you.
I
But if you
really was just like, what am I looking at? Plus on the paper it's like a horizontal, and I was like, oh gosh,
Yes, it was
I'm just a,
horizontal on the
I'm
paper. I had to
really a
flip
dumb
it.
paramedic, and I really don't get that. But then I started to really dig into it, and
Yes.
I dig it, for multiple reasons. I think sometimes when we read educational research, we see the use of assessments that aren't psychometrically valid. And so
Yeah.
we see people inventing a test that's not even really measuring learning. And these authors really did a good job. I was rereading some of the sentences around, they not only were accounting for interleaving and for different points at different moments where learners, some might have been in this rotation, some might have been in the other, and getting 900 different readings
Yeah.
with psychometrically valid measurements is like a feat. It's like I was just thinking, how could you reproduce this with paramedic students? And it is seriously challenging to measure that many times with that many learners. But when you put it all into this model and then they average out that graph, then you suddenly see, look, right when the learners went off on their clerkships, boom, there's this like super acute climb in their ability. And granted, it's just knowledge, it's not communication and all the clinical skills that go with patient care. So it isn't everything, but it is clearly significant. And that should tell us that waiting until the very end of paramedic school to begin going on hospital and field internships or exposure to those patients may be in really hurting us. Like, look at the extreme climb in ability and knowledge ability when we get into some of these psychiatry and OB
And
ones.
OB, yeah.
Gosh, that just says what don't just interleaving the hospital and the classroom experiences to improve knowledge and acquisition is probably better than just kind of trying to wait for everything at the end.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. So if you're looking at this for the first time, and I would encourage just take some time with this paper's open access. It's well written in the intro, and the discussion is definitely worth a read. They also spend a lot of time, to Dave's point about, it's not everything, it's not communications and other things. They actually say that in there, and they have a great limitations section that addresses that and more, about, and talks a lot about, these are some other areas that really need to be addressed. This is not the be all end all, but the if you take a close look at this, what we're looking at then is the, so you see months before and after, the 10 months before and 10 months after. Well, actually looking at longer than I thought. And then the CCSE scores, on in the y-axis. And when you're looking across the two dotted lines, that's the period of time during the clerkship. So you have months before the clerkship, you have the period of time. So it's, that's why you can see the 4-week intervals, and then down at the bottom, you can see that the surgery is twice as wide because it's 8 weeks. So it took me a little bit to like realize what I was looking at. And then when you pay attention to that dark line, and you see what Dave was talking about, which is the slope of learning, in between, just during the clerkship. Well, first of all, the learning before and after in across the board, and that's pretty significant too, because this is after. So this is after that clerkship has ended, and now we're measuring it. This is retention of knowledge later. And so, and then there's the during phase. And the during phase was really, I didn't even notice that at first until I read the discussion. Then I went back to it and said, wow, why is it not this steady increase like you see kind of in medicine? In internal medicine, it's almost a steady rise in scores. And same with really even pediatrics, although pediatrics takes a little jump too. Surgery was interesting because surgery had a little drop, and then, still a gradual increase, but during the clerkship. And they had a little interesting discussion section about that. They said it could have been because the clerkship learning was not aligned with the examination content, which I actually really like that they mentioned that, because I've heard that from students sometimes when I get feedback from them. Well, I think I didn't perform really well on this exam, airway exam or whatever, because I studied the wrong things. I didn't look at the things, or I felt like our preparation didn't reflect what we were actually tested on. And I've heard, students say this. So that kind of resonated with me, that maybe it was because their learning wasn't aligned with the examination content, or because the workload is so heavy that the students didn't have enough time to prepare for the exam. I mean, surgery, that might have been it. Heather?
Yeah, very much. And we see that on the surgery shelf exam too. So these are really long days for these learners. And if you and Dr. Rotman, who is our medical director at UCLA at paramedic school, used to say this to me all the time. Paramedic school is so much harder than medical school. And I never really understood what he meant. I was like, how could that possibly be? But he's really talking about the volume of learning that is condensed for paramedics into such a short amount of time. And paramedics, by nature of having already been at EMTs and understanding already what it's like to work a 12-hour shift or a 24-hour shift and all of that, many of our medical students have not had these experiences. And so to have to get up at 4 in the morning to do, or think about when you have had a surgical experience, if you've just been the patient, often you had, if you had a 6 o'clock surgery, you had to be at the hospital by 5 a.m. So that means the surgeons are pre-rounding. They need to be there before 5 a.m. oftentimes. And so these medical students are getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then their day doesn't, they're not done with all of their documentation or whatever until 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. And so we're like, yeah, that's not even a, that's not even a 24-hour shift. We're used to it. So, but they're not. And then that happens again tomorrow and again the next day. And so for them, there's quite a bit of acclimating to this kind of environment that is really taxing. They just have not. They just are not there yet. And so it's tough to then go home and do a bunch of studying when they have to prepare for tomorrow's cases. So that's one of the issues. And then much of surgery is really anatomy and physiology, it's structures. And so if you notice, if you remember the bar, the image that was all the bars,
Yeah.
it's the systems are like immune, behavioral, nervous
I'm
system.
into
It,
that.
it's not structures. It's not anatomy. It's not anatomy of the cardiovascular system. It's not thoracic anatomy or abdominal anatomy. And so you're making an important point about the content on this exam just doesn't have to, isn't really well aligned with surgery. It's actually there much more of the surgery exam has to do with medicine. Many more of the surgery items on this test, this clinical science test, is have to do with medicine. Infection, which meds are you going to use? Anesthesia kinds of questions. The questions about surgery happen to be more aligned with the basic sciences exam, which are about structures and anatomy. And so there's more sort of things that align with the surgery clerkship on the basic clinical sciences exam, which is a different test. It's just a
Yeah.
different, these comprehensive exams.
I was going to ask you if it was more procedural, if that, because I always think of surgery as procedures, techniques and things like that, but that makes sense. Great. So, one of the things that they said too about, so that was the, yeah, with surgery, the workload being heavy, they did mention about the impact of stress. They talked about the pandemic as well, which came right after this, but they're I'm not sure when they talked about up to summer 2019, really wasn't until the next year, but the measurement may have been taken, in that time. Although it doesn't look like it impacted a whole lot here. The other interesting one was psychiatry. So you see this flat kind of scoring pre-clerkship, a real steep incline during clerkship and then a flattened out, but still above the beginning of above phase one kind of learning. And which is a really interesting pattern. And they talked about that as it may be that this was the only, it may be the only source of psychiatry knowledge in their third year medical education, maybe in this clerkship. So this may, or their primary source, maybe within this clerkship. So I thought that was kind of interesting too. It made me think about what kinds of experiences do our students have where the clerkship or the actual clinical experience is the only or best way to actually get it. I would think obstetrics and neonatal care might be one of them, even though we can have simulation and other things. It's really, I think that might be one of the areas, Kim.
I was just going to say, I think pediatrics too, because, just knowing, first of all, when you talk about the age of people that are going through our programs and through medical school for that matter, probably the majority don't have kids. And so they don't even know what normal looks like. And if you have mannequins, that doesn't really show you. I mean, you can say skin and muscle tone and stare and whatever it might be, but and normal behavior. But until you see it, you have that, you have to have like that concrete experience. That's what, even reflecting back to what Dave was saying about that, interleaving the clinical experience with the content from the very beginning is so important because you're providing concrete examples that really make light bulbs go on and make them see like how things are related to each other. And so I think peds would be right at the top of my list of things people have to be able to see in a clinical setting.
I would just echo that, and I think when I think about how in the back of an ambulance or at a daycare center, if it's just to interact with kids that are even just healthy, the students, the EMT or paramedic student is engaging in even trying to explain their behaviors or actions, checking somebody's blood pressure. And they have to translate these kind of medical concepts into, I'm just a 2-year-old or a 5-year-old, and you're scary to me. And so it's not only that they have to account for all the potential diseases that are going through the brain of the student going, what could be this thing? But they also have to adapt and apply it in a context that is different. And I find that that really is we leave that often to the very end of the quote unquote clerkship or internship or patient care experience. But now thinking about it, I wonder if early interaction with kids may help promote that translation. And again, interleave it like Kim is saying. So interesting to flip some of these things. I love when we did the webinar where we flipped, instead of doing the lecture and then the test, if you do the test before the lecture, like you get better at it. This might be one of those cases where we always left OB and peds all the way to the end of the curriculum. And maybe we should have been thinking, sprinkle it in or do it earlier. Crazy.
We just need to find somebody to give us the money to develop this standardized exam and then
I
to
agree.
test it so that we could really see like what is the best approach for EMS because it's done in so many different ways.
Yeah, I was thinking that. That was sort of the meaning behind my question to Dr. Davis earlier about where did these exams come from? It wasn't a publisher that was producing them, right? These are exams that are coming from the medical licensing board. And I think that's something that would be interesting to think about in the future for EMS. The other thing that to Dave's point too was that they make a point of this, that the results showed that students' disciplinary knowledge was not affected by the rotation order. So remember, they're all in different orders here. So, and yet they all had knowledge acquisition.
My
I put
goal.
stars around that, Megan, because I actually thought that that was a really important takeaway from this study. It also verifies the methods. They did more of a linear regression than a multivariate regression. So on the stat side, that makes the charts that you have up make just a slight more sense, in that they could sort of pull the exact points where these people were at, independent of where they were in the rotation. I think that makes me feel a little bit better about putting our paramedic students out into the different places, right? Like you got the operating room first, so you got your airway experience earlier. Is that going to impact you later on in the ER, or this, the behavioral health unit, things like that? So it makes me feel a little bit better about when we send students, because we can't send everybody to the OR on the first day, right? Or we can't send everybody to the care center on the first day. So I guess that makes me sleep a little bit sounder at night, knowing that it really is. I don't want to say it doesn't matter. I would say maybe it's independent of which one you took first to vary. I thought that was interesting as we look at the knowledge acquisition in psychiatry. There seems to be a lot of behavioral health context in all of the places that we go. And I was like, gosh, I would have thought maybe those who went to psychiatry first might benefit them in some of the other subspecialties. That's not what they found, but this was sort of just a context I had in my mind.
Oh, so you went exactly where I was going. So I started thinking, we have tremendous problems with mental health in our profession, and we also tend to, again, leave that to the very end, do a very poor job of just a little bit of knowledge around psychiatric or mental health issues. But then what would happen if early on EMS providers were interacting around mental health providers and understanding a little bit more about just the dynamic around crisis, around how to just talk to people, and less focused on your, what do your kidneys do, and what does your liver do, and how does your heart work, and just a little bit earlier on might potentiate some of that clinical interaction that we really hope they'll have with all patients, and just be nice and be good listeners. And I think, wow, that clerkship really that resonated with me. I would rethink where we and how we do mental health internship slash clinical care experiences with EMS students.
Yeah. The other, so one of the things that comes up, and you're talking about different clinical clerkships, but and interleaving and when to start them. One of the questions we always kind of want to know is what is the basic level that you need before going to a clerkship would be too much. So trying to get at that, and I don't know if that question has been answered in medicine. Or if it's always being kind of moved around, but it's sort of like you need to know your multiplication tables before you can do calculus kind of thing. Do basic EKGs before you're put into a setting where you're expected to interpret them, that kind of thing. So have they kind of figured that out? Dr. Davis, I'll let you weigh in on that.
I think we would, in EMS, we would be surprised at how much shadowing is happening. And so there's quite a bit of being present in the space and observing others and what's happening, and l less responsibility, much more observing, see than do. Would you like to try just a piece of this? And given the short nature of our courses in EMS, whether it's just the few ride-alongs often that an EMT gets to do, or the abbreviated clinical experiences and then internship and the need to move to capstone, we see often, even if you're using a phased approach in the internship, that you sort of get a few shifts to do this many things and then you need to move on in increased level of responsibility, so that you can get to capstone where you're handling everything. During these core clerkships that we're talking about, learners are often not responsible for very many procedures. They're really focused on learning how to take a history and a physical exam. They might get to participate in certain activities or assist in a procedure, but they are not fully responsible for, they are part of a team, is really the kind of level of responsibility we're talking about here. So it's quite different. So They've often had very little previous exposure to patients when they arrive in these situations, and it's made to be just fine. That's okay. You can arrive there with only having simulation and practice in the on standardized patients, and that's okay. Whereas I think our you know in EMS we tend to be like, hey, put me in, coach, you got to be ready to go, hit the ground running kind of thing. And so we just think about how we ramp up that psychomotor skill progression in what we're doing from our lab experiences and going, mannequin, and then moving to our classmates and our high fidelity simulation, or to that clinical supervised setting, and then out into the field, working with real patients and taking on more responsibility is much more accelerated than in these situations. Now, remember, these are also more complex patients and they're getting more data. And even like if you look at the questions on this exam, it's one of the things that our colleague, Katie O'Connor, who's now a first-year medical student, was just asking me about the other day. She was like, what's with these items on these exams? They're a whole page long. And you think it, all of us who've done item writing at National Registry know we really try to have succinct items, like get to the point, cut out all this superfluous information. But when you look at these USMLE or NBME items, they tend to be quite long because the idea is you'll be presented with a patient's chart and you need to sort through what's important, what's useless, what information do you need to target in order to quickly identify the problem, relevant information, and disregard the rest of it. And so even that idea is quite different than the way that we manage our patients in our pre-hospital setting.
EMS, yeah, and we also tend to test for competency rather than test for learning. And that's one of the things we've talked about here in other studies, which is, testing or assessment for learning. They bring up something, and I think I'd love to hear your comments on this too, that developing a system that uses this type of standardized test, and they actually they feel that they contributed insights to the effectiveness of these clerkships, but they also thought that implementing this system with this standardized test at intervals can identify or could possibly be a system that can allow early detection of student difficulties and allow you to intervene, and it can measure the effectiveness of tutoring and other things. And I'm curious if you've seen that level of detail in measuring like the impact of when a student is struggling, identify an early detection system and then the effect of tutoring.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. If anybody has read Make It Stick, or if you haven't read it in a while, put it back in your rotation to listen to it on Audible or what have you. It's a good reminder, and maybe I'll drop an article from Rodinger in the chat about
Thank
the
you.
value of repeated testing and just. It does all kinds of things that are helpful to us. It primes us. It helps with that retrieval practice, but it also does, it helps with transfer in new and novel contexts. And we tend to, or at least learners tend to hold exams as like something awful. Dave was mentioning another article you had looked at a different time that when you take the test first, that it people did better when they were learning the material, and it's because it primes our brain to what to look for or what to attend for in the learning session. It helps us identify like what's important here. There's so many benefits of testing, but we sort of have conditioning, I think, probably from our K through 12 experiences of like to fear exams, or that they'll somehow be judging us rather than they're a way to help us prioritize information, sort help us focus on what's important. So, because often medical school students, those learners have been rock stars their entire life. They're used to doing very well. I think it is important to establish early how tests will be used. And so we used to, at UCLA, we used to have a philosophy of how do you know if you're going to have a quiz today? You showed up. There's a quiz every day. We just got, and we could demonstrate that learners would get better at taking quizzes. They would get better at their test-taking skills because not only did we take the quiz, we went over the quiz. So we would go over the ones that most people missed, and you could see, like, what were they asking? How do you know that this was the best answer and these ones were not? And that's an accumulation of skill you get over time, and you could see that they would get better at taking quizzes. And then eventually on those unit exams. And so those are important, but when they are not a frequent low stakes events, then they carry too much weight and people tend to fear them. And so you get a lot of that sort of test anxiety. People don't want to look in the mirror, they won't take the practice exam. So I think like Michigan here has set it up that these are requirements. You will do them. It's not an option. It's part of our process. They have predictive value. They've sort of put value and expectations for success, and then also have in place the right supports to support learners. So they didn't lower the bar. They help everybody get over the bar. And I think those are really important sort of ideas. I think we can go too far the other way where people say, well, we don't want a helicopter parent. These are adults. So let's do things like have self-assessments and they can use them any way they want. And then when you get learners who are maybe afraid to look in the mirror, aren't sure they're ready to see how used to it, how prepared they are. They put those off, and then they don't use the instruments that you're putting a lot of time or money into developing to let themselves really know where they're struggling. And then you don't realize until it's maybe a little bit too late who does need academic support or support in other ways. This might actually be something that
That's right.
needs behavioral wellness support, not even academic support.
Yeah, and they mentioned that in this. They talked about, maybe there's interventions that are needed, like coping skills or training on coping skills and that kind of thing, or just support. For to help as they go along, that frequent. And it's interesting. I'm trying to envision this, but I also think it might even help. Instructors, they do mention that would help instructors, including preceptors, with identifying difficulties in students and that kind of thing. So I think there's so many challenges that we face, and one of them is educators themselves, right? Trying to get educate the educators on things like experiential learning theory and these types of things. Michael?
I thought that was so important. As I try and contextualize what these brilliant folks are saying, is like it's not the test that necessarily always scares people. We certainly like build that up, but the biggest things we hear on some of our clinical and field rotations are like, which chair do I get to sit in? Where do I put my lunch in the fridge? Like those are the things that bring them stress, and we do a lot of things to try and overcome those, right? Like we do a whole clinical orientation. We give them, reference guides and cheat sheets. If we're not doing that in our classrooms for tests, in terms of practice tests, giving them some knowledge on how to answer questions that they've never been asked to answer before, it seems like those all would fit into the normal preparatory things that we do. I think sometimes, to Heather's point, we scare them to death about tests where we could actually use a similar strategy to how we prepare them for clinical and field to prepare them for some of these higher stakes exams. Yeah.
Great. Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering if anybody wants to look through a crystal ball or would like to see a charge. What's our charge for the future based upon things like this? They had a great, by the way, limitations section. Of course, it's one study, one school, one group of students, but it was also one of those, all students were participants, they weren't recruited. It wasn't a the impact of selection was not part of this. So, any
And it
final
was
words?
longitudinal too.
Yes, and longitudinal.
Yeah, I think if there are any tech takeaways for the EMS educator listening to this is, studying this with, implementing a change or implementing a process and then studying it throughout is doable, right? I would like to see us use some of this methodology. We have literally hundreds of schools that are using psychometrically valid, at least national registry results. So we might be able to see some of that. But I think just even using some of the measurements that we have to watch the effect of what happens when we interleave some of these interventions, educational interventions, I think this is completely doable. We might want to, phone a friend to help with the statistics and the graphing. Again, garbage in, garbage out. We don't want to have weird rubber band measurements that instead of actual rulers. So it's important to know kind of how we're going to know if we succeeded. But sometimes just the proof is in the pudding. Students who are more comfortable and have more success, and employers who are seeing a difference in the way that graduates interact. So, yeah, I think it's great.
Yeah, this is great. Check it out, read the study, and don't forget that we will be back next month. A big thank you to Dr. Heather Davis for joining us, and we'd love to hear more from Dr. Davis in the future, especially when it comes to studies like this on assessment testing. Where are we headed? Thank you to Kim McKenna and Michael Caduce, David Page, and to Limmer. And thank you for joining us. Next time, we will be here February 28th, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. And we're going to have a team of researchers with us, including Michael Caduce, who is the primary author on this study, Perceptions and the Use of Automated Hospital Outcome Data by EMS Providers. It's a pilot study, and we're going to talk about micro learning, one of my favorite subjects. So that will be on February 28th, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. But remember, you can join Dr. Remley Crowe, Dr. Tony Fernandez, and friends on Monday, February 10th for the clinical podcast. Remember, you can join us live each month. You can register at prehospitalcare.org and catch our YouTube archive if you missed any of them. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Have a great month. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.